Once upon a time in Detroit, a very young woman with a very strong sense of self went to school at Detroit School of Arts. This was a girl with hair that swooped down low over her left eye, a girl with style, grace, and a voice like butter. And she was about to break open some new chapters in Black girl stardom. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. It was 20 years ago that Aaliyah released her much-beloved self-titled Red album, and just weeks later died in a plane crash in the Bahamas on the way home from a video shoot. Some of us have never been the same.
The pain that we feel over like a Whitney or a Prince, I got an early feeling of that with Aaliyah because it just didn't feel fair, and you never thought that she wouldn't be here to give us more art, for better or worse.
Detroit writer Imani Mixon wrote an appreciation of this late idol for the Detroit Metro Times.
She just didn't sound like anything we'd ever heard before. I think sometimes when you get a voice that's that angelic, you expect, I don't know, a harp or a violin, but to have like a bass heavy beat and like a full on production crew ready to make you just sound and glow even more. Was something that was really appealing to like fourth grade me.
It seems like she was in the driver's seat for much of her own style and aesthetic. Do you have a sense coming up in Detroit with its unique fashion culture and unique history, what she may have taken from this place?
You know, I don't know if it would be something that manifested in her style as much as maybe the way she went about things. I think Detroit is a cool city and she was very much a cool girl, but from what I learned from her stylist Derek Lee that I talked to for the story, it was a very hands-on collaborative effort between them to make her style happen and to also make it something that was universal as opposed to rooted in one place. Like I don't really think we ever saw her in like a mink or a big leather or something like that in the way that we would if she was particularly going for like a Detroit entertainer style.
Yeah. In terms of her musical style, when I think back to who was big around that time, you know, there was Mariah Carey and En Vogue and all these, you know, sort of untouchable goddess type figures, you know, the real super mega stars. And then Toni Braxton and Whitney were doing grown-up lady music. You know, it was a little generationally different. And then here came Aaliyah singing about really relatable relationships and singing about vulnerability. It kind of felt like a revelation.
For sure. And I think it was a really good, really good entry way into what love could be like. You know, like I feel like sometimes younger singers, you kind of only get bubblegum pop where you get like the sweet part of things. And maybe this was a peek into her real life, but I feel like we got all angles of what a relationship could, should, and shouldn't be through her. Mm-hmm. But it was still very, very fun to listen to. There was nothing that was like too daunting in her music, I would say.
I didn't quite put it together that when she was on her way up and she was making songs like AJ Nothing But a Number and At Your Best, she was enrolled at DSA. she was going to school. When I feel what did people tell you about that period?
That it happened really quickly. I think when we retell stories, it's really easy to exaggerate. But when I spoke to the past principal, Dr. Denise Davis Cotton, she mentioned that Aaliyah had only been there for like a year. So like her sophomore year is when she started going on the road and traveling. And obviously it made a big impact on her. She came back for prom, she came back for graduation, but she wasn't there all the time and she wasn't there for long.
Yeah. Did you recognize her in when you were a kid and listening to her, did you recognize her as in certain ways signaling Detroit?
Not necessarily, and I can't speak to whether or not that was on purpose or not, but I think, Detroit pride is a thing. There are a lot of other big black cities that have a similar pride, and like an Eminem or a Big Sean, that is central to their character arc. Whereas with Aaliyah, I think because no one really knew where she was from, because she was born in New York and lived there when she was younger and then came here, it just wasn't at the forefront of her story. But locally, we knew. People who live here knew that Aaliyah was from here and lived here, and it was just like a spark, like maybe just around the corner, something will turn for me as well when it's time for me to have a career or when it's time for me to make art.
Yeah. Why do you think Detroit wasn't as much a part of her public origin story?
I think a lot wasn't a part of her public origin story. I think in hindsight, she was, she could be anything or anyone. And I think that, is a beautiful invitation. But within that, you also can't necessarily root her in a place. It's really hard to pinpoint where her sound is because of change and her style. So I think it also maybe is just a reflection of her youth. Like she didn't have to make up her mind. She didn't have to have one thing that she did over and over. She clearly wasn't a one-trick pony if we're talking about her 20 years later.
Right.
So I think the parts of Detroit that impacted her, which I was definitely trying to dig into in the story, are sort of fantasy readings, things that we have to imagine or maybe even project onto her because they're not readily available. But I don't think it was even necessarily on purpose as much as, she had a very close to the chest life. Like she didn't really tell us too much. And this was before the cults of celebrity where we know everything all the time and we know what you have for breakfast. So I think she existed in the perfect time for the kind of art that she was making. It was right before social media, right before digital media became readily available, and she was able to just do her thing.
Yeah. You did speak with Eric Seitz, and he and his partner, Rapture Stewart, who are known as Key Beats Inc. in their professional lives, they were a very important producing team for Aaliyah. What did Eric have to say about those or her in those years?
Everybody had beautiful things to say. And I think, like, isn't that the legacy that we want to have when we're all gone and everybody's just gushing over how great you were?
Yeah.
But I think the beautiful thing for me to discover is just, trying to look at her through the lens of being an art school kid. Like, she really lived the art school kid dream. Everybody wants to travel, to have people know them by their first name, to have their art out there. And he was also an art school kid. So I think they were able to bond over the music and also like the entertainment factor of things, the performance, the style. And yeah, he just gave a lot of insight. And apparently she was like a next door neighbor of his when he moved to New York. So they used to like go shopping to fill up his apartment at Pottery Barn, or she would go to Times Square and go to the movies by herself. Like that kind of stuff, I think was really sweet just to get an idea of who she actually was. Although I do think she actually was, a major entertainer, she was also a young woman trying to figure things out and trying to signal a different time in her career with this album. And I think that is what readers and like me as a writer, like what I really tried to take seriously with the story.
In just a minute, Imani's going to talk to us about Aaliyah's Red album and what makes it so memorable. That's after a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Imani, there's a ghost in this profile. a name that's never spoken, something that you allude to in a way that anyone familiar with the story of Aaliyah cannot miss. And I'm sorry to go there because you worked so hard to lift up different truths about her life. But I wanted to ask you about R. Kelly. For those who aren't familiar, Aaliyah's uncle introduced them, and Kelly produced songs for her. And this is a man who, as we speak, is on trial for racketeering and sex trafficking. And he sexually abused Aaliyah, and he got her into an illegal marriage when she was 15. She worked very, very hard to not be defined by that and to not discuss what happened in the years after. Why did you make the choice not to write about that chapter of her life?
I definitely think it came from a place of love and hopefully understanding. Like, I don't know anything more than, you know, anybody else who's been following the news cycle knows. But I didn't want to define her by her worst possible relationship. And I think that we've seen a lot of other women, a lot of other pop stars end up in that cycle of talking about their abuser or their ex, or both. And I just didn't want to. I think for my own sort of emotional clarity and mental health, it wouldn't have been a productive writing project. And it was much more inviting to talk about the life that she did have and the life that she was proud of. And also the fact that this was an album he did not touch. So to have somebody be so hands-on with your first couple albums and then be completely, you know, erased from the picture purposefully. So I think that is what I took from it, and it didn't merit my writing for me. And I really do appreciate the investigative journalists and the breaking news journalists who are able to give us back-to-back updates about him. But I was not interested in that. And if it's her story, it's her story.
Sure. Well, you don't really get to that third album without some of the changes that she went through in her second record, One in a Million. And at this point in her career, she was working with Missy Elliott. She's working with Timbaland. How do you see her having changed in that artist in a way that paved the way for that later record that you find most interesting?
I think, you know, when back in the day, if you were working with Missy and Timbaland, you were ready to try something new. You were ready to experiment. You were ready to be a little bit weird.
Yeah.
I think that's what they bring to sound. And it's something you don't know you can dance to until you dance to it. So I would imagine that she was enjoying that newness, where it is R&B, but it's something completely new. It's not a cover. It's not something our parents listen to. And I think that paved the way for the Aaliyah album because, you know, if you make something with your name on it, you're assuming that people will gravitate toward it and understand it as who you are. And from the conversations I had with Eric Seitz, you know, everything we heard in that Aaliyah album was real life. Her songwriters were talking with her about life to write the album. So I think this is probably the closest we'll get to her real life was Aaliyah. And it's cool if everything else had other people pulling the strings. But for Aaliyah, it really felt like she was in the driver's seat. And I really enjoyed being a passenger.
Yeah. Yeah. When she died, some people just took it so hard. There were tattoos of her name and her face showing up. It's fandom as we now recognize it in Nipsey Hussle and the way people are about Michael Jackson. Did you know folks who loved her like that and were affected that way by her death?
I didn't know anyone close to her necessarily, but I think the beauty of her being so universal is that it was really easy to love her or to think that, you know, if we met, we'd be really cool friends. So I think just for me in general, like losing a young girl is not a good feeling. And I think everyone, of course, we wanted to look like her, dance like her, sound like her. So to know that, you know, she's not on earth anymore, it was just a big adjustment. My cousin was currently at JZU when she passed, which is where Aaliyah attended school. And we went skating the day after she passed, and it became like a memorial skate. Like, you know, everything was an Aaliyah song. So I think that also brought me back to a memory. But I just think the pain that we feel over like a Whitney or a Prince I got an early feeling of that with Aaliyah, because it just didn't feel fair, and you never thought that she wouldn't be here to give us more art, for better or worse.
You write in the essay that for a generation of Black women like yourself, that plane crash in the Bahamas was in some ways the beginning of years and years of losses that would follow. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
For sure. So I think at that point, I had a really sheltered, semi-privileged childhood, and I hadn't had any close losses in my life. So I was very invested in, you know, music and entertainment, and to have her gone just didn't feel right. Like, I think it, you know, it becomes a moment where you start to think about, you know, what is death? How long do I get to be here? How do I go? And yeah, the circumstances surrounding her death is just tragic. That's the only way you can put it. So I think in my mind, and in an ideal world, every Black woman gets to live, you know, in peace and harmony and happiness for as long as she can and wants to, and nothing bad ever happens to her. But it did definitely feel like a personal loss that she left, and also knowing, you know, like now with police brutality or even something as close as 9/11, like there are other losses. This pandemic gave us so many losses, and I think it was at the precipice of, you know, a lifelong system or rhythm of having to deal with losing people and things.
Imani, will you share some favorite songs?
Oh my gosh, yes. So I was interviewing Eric Seitz and trying to be really professional and not fangirl, but he told me that my favorite song on the album, called It's Whatever, was something that he made 10 years ago. The beat was something he made 10 years ago, just so happened to have it on him and showed it to her. And that is my absolute favorite song in the album. It definitely changes depending on maybe the time of my life, but for the last year or so, I would say It's Whatever is my favorite, because, you know, in the song, she's like, it's whatever, like, we can do whatever, doesn't matter, but you can tell that it does matter. So yeah. I love the lyricism of that song. I love how airy and flowy the beat is. I think It's Whatever is also a good mantra. Like, even if I don't all the way feel this, even if I can't all the way affirm this emotion, it's whatever. Like, it's going to be what it's going to be. And that's the one that carries me.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. You can find full Stateside episodes at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Today's podcast was produced by Aaron Allen and April Van Buren. Our theme music is by 14KT. Additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Williams.
I'm Lester Graham. We've been working on a big project about Great Lakes birds called The Bird Connection.
It will look at ducks and trumpeter swans,
egrets and herons,
and piping plovers. Yes!
We'll discuss what we've discovered at a Michigan Public Issues and Ale event,
including how some problems for birds are problems for people.
It's at Arbor Brewing Company in Ypsilanti, the evening of May 21st at 7.
You can register at michiganpublic.org.